You know how important it is to ensure that your supplements are genuine, safe, and effective. That's why I partnered with Fullscript, an online dispensing platform that only offers curated professional-grade brands that I know and trust. The very same supplements that I prescribe to my patients and take myself. Never counterfeit or expired, always stored and shipped correctly. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to start your free Fullscript account. Buying through Fullscript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, a mobile-friendly site. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA-compliant and offers world-class support. Fullscript also gives you access to my custom-targeted supplement protocols that combine the products that I recommend to address specific needs, heart health, immune support, and much more. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to sign up for your free Fullscript account. You'll get access to the supplements and features you need to help you achieve your wellness goals. That's DearHoffmanStore.com. DearHoffmanStore.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Our guest, Dr. Michael Ruscio. His credentials are that he is a board-certified chiropractor, as well as a naturopathic physician. That's a great combo. He's a clinical researcher and author of Healthy Gut, Healthy You, the personalized plan to transform your health from the inside out, which is a great introduction to this subject. Dr. Ruscio, let's go through some of the ways that we can alter the microbiome. Now, there are various diets. Let's start with diet. You know, changing your diet, does that change the bugs within us?
It does. I think it's really important to lead with that sort of food first perspective. And this is what we lay out in Healthy Gut, Healthy You. Let's start with food and with lifestyle. Because, gosh, we want to make sure before we go any further down the path of testing, supplements, what have you, if this is something that you're eating your way into, then we address it there. And you can shift your bugs. I think it's more aptly framed as you shift the relationship between your bugs and your immune system. And I'll give you one example as to how. Looking at the low FODMAP diet, which reduces prebiotics, that's been shown to reduce dysbiosis, but it's also been shown to reduce leaky gut and inflammation. And I think it's the whole ecosystem and how that functions together rather than just trying to say, well, we're going to force one bacteria up or down. We're thinking more ecosystem modulation and the immune system and therefore resultant inflammation as a byproduct of that. So yes, it's very modifiable with diet.
So what is SIBO? And how is it diagnosed and how does it have a relationship to brain symptoms or bodily symptoms or various maladies?
Yeah. Well, SIBO brings us into the small intestine. Small intestinal bacterial overgrowth is what the acronym stands for. And it's important to clarify that the small intestine is 22 feet in length, whereas the large intestine is 5 feet in length. 95% of calories and nutrition are absorbed in the small intestine. And it's where most of the immune system is located. So it's really, if we were going to say one section of the gastrointestinal tract was the most important, it would be the small intestine. It's a very intricate absorptive membrane that can also be a big problem for immune dysfunction and inflammation if there's leakage or ill health there.
It's actually the site of celiac disease damage, because celiac disease is a little hard to diagnose based on, you know, the upper endoscopy. They look down, or looking up from the rear end, you know, with a colonoscopy. It's in that area that's sort of like that dark side of the moon that you can't see with a scope. So sometimes you have to take a pill, you know, like this, camera, this
capsule endoscopy,
capsule endoscopy to see the damage that occurs with in the small intestine, which is a little less accessible to the scoping.
Yeah. And this is part of the reason why I think the small intestine has had less discussion, exactly to your point. It's very hard to assess. And this is where measures of leaky gut can give some indication. Breath tests that analyze for SIBO can also give some indication. And when you have an overgrowth of bacteria, this can be one of the things that leads people to have what perhaps some of the listeners have experienced, which is this feeling of, gosh, I eat healthy food, but I feel worse. You know, I eat a big salad, yet I feel bloated. And that can be because some plant matter can be rich in these FODMAPs, these prebiotics, feed the pre-existing overgrowth, and then you feel the bloating, the distension. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it can fuel constipation, sometimes diarrhea, sometimes both. And it's very able to be remedied, but that's what SIBO is.
Bubble, bubble, toil and trouble, sort of, because there's excess gas yeah. production, which can be detected yeah. in a breath test. So a paradigm that I entered medicine with, you know, and it was very exciting to learn about this, you know, with Dr. Crook in the 1970s and 1980s, was the yeast connection. How right. has the yeast connection weathered the test of time? Because it plays a role, but maybe it's been subsumed among as a subcategory among other types of GI problems.
And you could make a case maybe to subsume it because it's, you know, fungus in the gastrointestinal tract, including Candida albicans, but not limited to, is a fraction of what the bacteria amount to in terms of relative population. However, one study that assessed people with idiopathic symptoms, we don't know why they have the gas, the bloating, the distension, the pain. Mm-hmm. They found about 20% had SIBO, 20% had CFO, fungal overgrowth, and 20% had both. No. So it is something that occurs. And again, it's not easy to really assess this in the small intestine. You can do a stool test, but there was one recent paper I found absolutely fascinating. What they did in this paper, it was just one individual, but nevertheless, I think the results are pretty important to discuss. They had this person brush their teeth once per day for 2 days, and then for two additional days after every meal. So they went back and forth once per day after every meal. They found a 10 to 100 fold change in the amount of candida in the stool based upon how people brushed their teeth. Hmm. All that just to say, definitively diagnosing candida via a stool test, I think is challenging. If you look at the reference ranges used across various papers, it can vary greatly. Right. You can test antibodies, but those haven't been validated to discriminate between healthy controls and ill cohorts. So you can do the testing, but it should really be taken with a grain of salt because it's only suggestive at best.
Yeah, and I'm glad you bring that up because stool testing is popular in functional medicine, and you get a readout of all the different bugs inside you, and some people take it as the gospel truth, and there are even indications that this is a bad bug and we have to zap this with, I don't know, berberine, or even there's list antibiotics that can kill the bad bugs. How reliable are these tests, and do you use them, and do you kind of take it with a grain of salt?
We use them much, much, much more rarely than we used to.
That's interesting.
And again, I say this as and I say this as someone who had a parasite. So if anyone's going to be biased, it would be me. And I was actually, admittedly, a bit biased in the early years of my career, wherein I was doing two overlapping stool tests on pretty much everyone I worked with. Mm-hmm. And so I've examined probably 2,000 stool tests.
Right.
And boy, are they inconsistent in terms of the same person. In fact, we've recently done this, and we're going to probably publish on this at some point. Same person, passive bowel movement, half goes into kit A, half goes into kit B, and the results rarely match. So I think it's important that we have this conversation because when someone's not feeling well, they're very amenable to the, well, I know you're not feeling well. If we just test, this will tell us why. And clinicians, I think, have to do a better job of sort of policing how they think about mm-hmm. testing, because there's no real strong incentive for anyone to do this other than the doctor, meaning the labs are going to market to the doctor all the beneficial claims. And then patients, just like pharmaceuticals, you know, are you not feeling well? Think about Celexa or whatever it is.
So what you're saying is there's a role for the practitioner as a gatekeeper of reasonable therapies, but you know, there's also cost consideration because the price of going to an integrative physician can be exorbitant if it's not covered by insurance. Yeah.
And also sometimes the patient will think the doctor doesn't care if he doesn't want to do a test.
Yeah.
This is more of an issue, I think, in conventional medicine. But it's important for the integrative healthcare consumer to try to evaluate this on a per provider basis. Does your provider seem like they care and they're making a good case against the testing, or are they just kind of hand waving you away, not listening? Yep. Yep. And those are different, but you should be able to, as an individual, as a healthcare consumer, make that determination. And it's really important because, you know, there's all this pressure. If the patients are being educated by the labs, you need this test because of X, and then they go to the doctor's mm-hmm. office, yeah, there's no incentive for being reasonable. In fact, sometimes the clinician has to suffer the slings and arrows of discontent from the patient if yep. they feel like, well, why won't you do a stool test, yep. a SIBO test, and a urine test, not understanding that the accuracy of all of those may be shockingly low.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I appreciate your perspective as an experienced clinician, because I've also developed some skepticism about testing. And you can get a lot more bang for your buck sometimes with simpler measures, you know, common sense measures that make the patient feel better without necessarily going on that magical mystery tour of right. excessive testing, because you get this TMI phenomenon, too much information, that can sometimes be baffling and dazzling and not, you know, conceal the simple truth. We now know that some of the things that inhabit the intestine are what are called anaerobes, okay? Because, we're familiar with lactobacillus. We can test it in the stool. We can buy it in the health food store. But some of what's going on there is very hard to test, because as soon as the sample is exposed to air, it changes. So one of the new solutions that's been proposed is Akkermansia. Akkermansia is all the rage these days. There's a right. company called Pendulum, which makes it. Other companies are copying them. Are you on the Akkermansia bandwagon when it comes to restoring intestinal health? What's your take?
Yeah, no, I'm not on the bandwagon. And we have recently released a very comprehensive review on this. If people want to just search my name and Akkermansia, we go through it in a very data-driven perspective. Firstly, I appreciate Pendulum and what they're trying to do in bringing a new probiotic to market. That's not easy to do. And I think the more options the healthcare consumer has, the better. That being said, what often happens is the new is the best. And this is where I have some real concerns with how some of the people at the Pendulum company are representing that probiotic when they do podcast interviews and what have you. You know, one is saying that it's vastly superior for metabolic health due to the GLP-1 action, yep. the glucagon-like
that's
peptide
sort of like
action.
A natural Ozempic.
Ozempic, right. And a big credit to our research team for just going through the data, and we made a comparison table where you look at multiple markers, fasting insulin, hemoglobin A1C, triglycerides, cholesterol, weight loss. And there's one or two markers where the Akkermansia is superior, but there's a lot more markers wherein the traditional lactobacillus and bifidobacterium probiotics are actually better for metabolic health. And there's certainly many more studies. Mm-hmm. So from a metabolic perspective, I mean, okay, there's two clinical trials showing a slight benefit for a couple markers, mm-hmm. but then there's many, many, many other meta-analyses showing similar or superior efficacy for the lactobacillus and bifidobacterium blends. So it can help, but I think how it's misrepresented is it affects this mechanism, therefore it's better, and they don't actually just say, well, let's look at the comparison outcome data to really tell us the truth on this.
Yeah, backing up a little bit, I think what we're talking about is the impact of probiotics on metabolism, that there's this notion that, I mean, it's based on research where it shows that if you take a stool sample from an obese mouse and put it into a skinny mouse, the skinny mouse will suddenly develop obesity. Moreover, they've taken stool samples from obese humans and put them into normal skinny mice, and the mice tend to put on weight. So there is a profound effect on metabolism, maybe on insulin resistance or via other mechanisms, food absorption, calorie uptake, you know, a lot of things going on there that the microbiome has an impact on.
Correct. But it is, I think, important also to mention that in the probiotic literature, the impact on weight loss, 2 to 4 pounds, you know, it's not that big. It's statistically significant, but it's not what I would call clinically meaningful.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're not looking for it. So far, we haven't found the holy grail to weight loss.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm a big proponent of probiotics because there's really compelling data for multiple conditions. But as it pertains to weight loss, it's not really impressive.
Do you have a go-to favorite, species of probiotics, or, is it pretty much generic?
We have a heuristic that we use. So taking a step back, I think it's mostly marketing when a company says, this is our special probiotic and it's the best because of XYZ. Mm-hmm. Because as more and more data is being published, what you're seeing is similar formulas. Similar formulas will have impact on the same condition. So different probiotics will be helpful for IBS, for IBD. Mm-hmm. There have been some comparison studies that have looked at constipation and given two different formulas and found similar results. I mean, there's literally hundreds of clinical trials on probiotics. And so I think the best way to approach this, and this is a paper we're currently working on, we're hoping to have it published by the end of the year, which would, we call it a meta protocol, just looking at across all of the trials. What are the commonalities so we can simplify this rather than making it more complicated? But remember, the complicated messaging is usually by the companies who sell the probiotics, mm-hmm. sort of spinning. Like Akkermansia is a good example, yep. telling you it's the best probiotic, which is not really what the data support. So you have your traditional lactobacillus and bifidobacterium blend. This is something like a Visbiome, a VSL3, mm-hmm. right? Really common.
Which is used for specifically targeting ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, that kind of thing.
Yep. And helpful for IBS, yep. Right? So there's a lot of conditions that type of probiotic can help. Similar probiotics have been shown effective for depression in a different mm-hmm. meta-analysis. Mm-hmm. A different altogether, actually a fungus, this is your Florastor or your Saccharomyces boulardii. Yep. Mm-hmm. And then a newer kid on the block, so to speak, are these soil-based probiotics, which yep. are usually some type of a bacillus species. And two meta-analyses in the past 6 months, one by Alex Ford at the University of Leeds and another one from an Asian group, summarized 50-some-odd clinical trials, and then the other one summarized 80-some-odd clinical trials. And they find a few species of lactobacillus or bifidobacterium have efficacy, Saccharomyces have efficacy, and then bacillus have efficacy. So we recommend people just look for a quality probiotic that satisfies either one of these types, mm-hmm. or if they really want to do something right. powerful, our speculation, not published, but combine all three.
Right.
And we call this triple therapy. And this is used with antibiotics. We're just borrowing that concept and using it for mm-hmm. probiotics.
Right. So,
the dosages.
Yeah, I think we're probably a little ways from what are called like functional probiotics, like a probiotic for women who get urinary tract infections that makes them, bulletproof vis-a-vis urinary tract infections, or a probiotic that cures ulcerative colitis, or a probiotic that makes the pounds melt off. We're not quite there yet.
Yeah, and I think the frame that works best is not thinking about them like drugs with a narrow mechanism of action, but rather pleiotropic. Mm-hmm. And coming back to our earlier conversation about how the gut impacts so many things, if the intervention heals the gut, then it could help someone with depression. It could help someone with diarrhea, or conversely, someone with constipation. And we see this. We see the same formula, and so some people will help constipation.
They're sort of like Swiss that. Army knife kinds of things, optimizers.
They're corrective, yeah. They're corrective. And regarding dosages, if you're using a lactobacillus and bifidobacterium blend type probiotic, anywhere from 1 to 50 billion CFU per day. Mm-hmm. If you're using Saccharomyces boulardii, between 10 and 15 billion CFU per day. And if you're using bacillus, usually between 2 and 6 billion CFU per day. And I would recommend using one for 2 to 3 months and then reevaluating. Usually people will see benefit before that, but you may not experience the full impact until the second or third month.
I wanted to switch gears and talk a little bit about some of the botanicals that are used for GI problems. There's peppermint, there's ginger, there's berberine, some others. You in your journey to eradicate parasites, you may have just gotten a straight drug treatment, but sometimes It helps to use botanicals. So what role do they play in your practice?
Yeah, I'm excited to say that we have a paper currently in peer review where we treated SIBO, small intestinal bacterial growth, with herbal antimicrobials, and we demonstrated efficacy. And I think it's the second, maybe the third paper that's demonstrated that. So the research regarding antimicrobial herbs is in its nascency, but it does exist. And there's certainly some pretty powerful anecdotes. And actually, one other clinical trial I can mention is garlic capsules for vaginal yeast infections in women, showing to be about as effective as fluconazole. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, many different interesting herbs. You mentioned a few, oregano, caprylic acid, artemisinin, black walnut, garlic, or allicin as one of the extracts. Mm-hmm. And typically you'll see blends used. This is what we used. There's another paper by Jerry Mullins, who I believe is at Hopkins, who used a different blend and demonstrated similar efficacy as rifaximin, the FDA-approved antibiotic for IBS, and can also treat SIBO. So yeah, it's pretty wonderful the amount of options that people have that are herbal in nature.
Mm-hmm. Specifically, you know, what are some of the properties of things like ginger or peppermint for settling the stomach? Do you find that they're helpful?
Yeah. There's some interesting data on ginger. On peppermint. There's a compound known as IBGuard, which has some interesting trials. It's amongst other mechanisms, can be an antispasmodic. Mm-hmm. So especially for diarrheal type. Ginger, anti-inflammatory, may be better for nausea, and also could be and can function as a prokinetic. So if people have dyspepsia, indigestion, prolonged fullness, then ginger may be a good option also.
What about bitters? You know, in traditional naturopathic medicine, bitters play a major role because they're so therapeutic for GI problems. Is that a go-to for you?
I haven't used bitters much, and part of the reason for this is I don't think low stomach acid is as common as maybe the natural health community has proclaimed. Mm-hmm. There are some risk factors to look at. So someone can do sort of a self-audit. If you have a history of anemia or a current anemia, that's one factor. If you have an autoimmune condition, that's another factor. And if you're over 65, that's another factor. Mm-hmm. And those may lead you up to a 50% chance that someone has low stomach acid. But the way I've been using supplemental acid, and there is a once in a while case where, man, that acid really helps. But I like to modulate inflammation and the microbiome first and then reevaluate. Because in my view, a symptomatic response is crucial to qualify if the acid is helpful. And so if you have bacterial overgrowth, that can cause a lot of the same symptoms as low stomach acid. Mm-hmm. But you theoretically need stomach acid forever, whereas you can clear the overgrowth and then not need to treat that in an ongoing fashion. So we start with the treatments that are more curative. I hate using that term, but you know what I mean, in terms of resolving the SIBO. Mm-hmm. And then reevaluate. And if someone is still having burping, indigestion, prolonged fullness, try an acid supplement or bitters, right? This is either one, kind of, they're both doing the same thing, but via different mechanisms. Bitters stimulate acid. Hydrochloric acid supplements just give the acid and see if those symptoms respond. And usually they're going to respond within a week, and that will let you know that you need the acid.
Do you think there's a role for antifungal medication from time to time? Because I'm, you know, as a physician, you know, I got the prescription pad, I can prescribe nystatin or fluconazole for people where I suspect there's a yeast problem. Do you think is helpful, or should we instead be looking for gentler herbal approaches?
Well, I like to think of this in a hierarchical fashion where I start with diet and lifestyle. I think, you know, we as the healthcare community should start with diet and lifestyle. Second to that would be probiotics, because probiotics are pretty potent antimicrobials, whether it's antibacterial or antifungal. And then after that, consider either herbal antimicrobials or pharmaceutical antibiotics or antifungals. Mm-hmm. But I have no bias against, I mean, it's more about selecting the right therapy at the right time than it is, are antibiotics bad? And, you know, that's one thing maybe I should just mention really quickly. I think antibiotics have gotten a bad rap, but whether it's an antibiotic, an herbal antimicrobial, or a antifungal of prescription or natural sourcing, at the right time, those can be really helpful. We just want to be careful to your earlier point, not to see a little bit of disturbance on a stool test and say, oh, we got to go guns a-blazing.
Treat the test and not the patient. Right. Is there a role in your approach for digestive enzymes? They're popular. They're different formulas.
Right. Where do they fit? I also think they're overused. Yep. This would be more of an end phase consideration along with the acid. And this is where you'll sort of build a case for someone. You know, is the person over 65? Do they have an autoimmune condition? Have they had anemia? Those are all suggestive of acid. Do they have looser bowels? Is there maybe a low elastase on a previous test indicating pancreatic insufficiency? Mm-hmm. And if so, once you've modulated their diet and lifestyle and their microbiota with probiotics and potentially antimicrobials or prescriptions, then you reevaluate their symptoms and perhaps you give them the HCL or the enzymes. But I don't think they're as necessary as they're proclaimed to be. Mm-hmm. And part of that, I think, comes from this sort of, we're going to do many things at once. You're going to come in, you're going to go gluten-free, on fish oil, on curcumin, on the paleo diet, on antimicrobials, on enzymes. And the person says, yeah, I feel better. And the clinician goes, see, you needed all those things. And I think doing this in a more stepwise fashion reduces the amount of therapeutics that we need and gives a clinician better feedback in terms of what things are actually helping and what things are maybe superfluous.
You know, in a truly holistic approach, and I'm sure you embrace this, there is a, you know, a gut-brain connection, but there's also a brain-gut connection. And sometimes stress and learned responses can create GI problems. So how do you approach that? Do you approach it with various types of psychological interventions, meditation, relaxation training, or are certain herbs that have a calmative effect in general that you can use for people? That's a big theme.
Boy, I'm so glad that you brought this up, because for some people, if you don't handle this correctly, you will not improve their health. And it sort of depends on the presentation. Some people you can tell are very, very concerned about their health, right? You ask them a question and they write you a 4-paragraph answer. Is your bloating better or worse? Well, it might be, but 2 Tuesdays ago, I went out for a drink, and then 2 days later, I noticed I had some bloat, right? And it's just, oh my goodness, there's just so much, almost obsession over their health. They might have a diagnosis of anxiety, or they might just be an anxious type. Mm-hmm. So for those people where they really seem worried, something like limbic retraining can be helpful, which is a type of meditation, essentially.
Right.
I'm a huge fan of time in nature, which has been shown to reduce the amygdala and its overactivation. Exercise. And sometimes just rearming people with an empowering narrative. Yeah. We tend to give people, we call it the ancestral stressors protocol. We have them do cold showers, sauna, if they have access to it. We give them the What Doesn't Kill Us book. It's Scott Carney's Chronicling of Wim Hof. The Iceman who hiked Everest in a pair of shorts, and then also Can't Hurt Me by David Goggins.
I hope you don't make all your patients bathe in like ice water.
No, we say cold shower, take it whatever pace you can.
Yeah, okay.
But the point, and we also have them do a health research detox.
Yep.
And all this is meant to help them understand how strong and resilient they are. And we'll also say you need to kind of have a give the middle finger to healthcare mentality for a little while, because you care too much right now.
Yeah.
So, you know, any of those or a combination of can be hugely, hugely helpful for some people. Absolutely.
Well, that's great that you pay attention to that dimension, because I think that's an important dimension. On the one hand, we don't want to say, well, all your symptoms are psychosomatic. On the other hand, we don't want to negate that important dimension because people people have visceral a hyper attention sometimes. It's almost like they're a little bit too inwardly focused. Certain types of meditation or certain activities can take that focus away and kind of change the brain circuitry around that.
Yeah, and it's not all in the brain. There was one study that correlated activation of the limbic system, having a stressed state, and how inflammatory their blood was. They actually drew blood and then exposed the monocytes to various antigens and it legitimately manifest as being more inflammatory. So the good news is there are things you can do to quell that. But to your point, it's definitely not all in your head. The brain connects to the immune system. Absolutely.
And there's a tremendous enteric nervous system network within the gut. They actually say that probably there may be as many neurons in your gut as there are in your brain. So
right, you know. Right.
Well, great stuff. Obviously, lots more in the book. And the book is Healthy Gut, Healthy You, The Personalized Plan to Transform Your Health from the Inside Out. And I got to say that, you know, among the welter of books on this subject, your book really stands out. And your perspective is extremely nuanced and very balanced, which I really appreciate, because sometimes people go off on a hobby horse of one kind or another, and they tend to put their blinders on, and you know they're not taking into account all the factors, and you seem to incorporate that in your approach. Give us a heads up on your podcast once again, please.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I just want to thank all the people I've worked with, because they've really helped fill in my blind spots. Because there was a point in time when I thought the paleo diet would cure the world.
Yep.
And then you see a number of people for whom it doesn't work. And so you have to start sort of fortifying your weak points. But no, thank you. I appreciate that. And the podcast is just under my name. It's Dr. Michael Ruscio, easily able to be found on YouTube or Google. And yeah, it's been a great conversation. I really appreciate your attention to detail and open-mindedness and just the broadness of your scope.
Well, thank you so much. And we also want to acknowledge that you have a telehealth capability via drruscio, RUSCIO.com. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us, and I'll keep an eye on your work as you progress in your understanding of these complex problems. I'm sure you have a lot to contribute. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you again. It's been a great call.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I want to thank you for listening to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or your favorite podcast app, and get new episodes automatically downloaded every weekday. And please give us a rating and review. It truly helps new people discover Intelligent Medicine. The Intelligent Medicine Podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice, and no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of information on this podcast or materials linked from this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they may have, and should seek the assistance of their health care professionals for any such conditions. Finally, please visit drhoffman.com and discover everything Intelligent Medicine has to offer, including frequently updated, unbiased health news and fully vetted product and supplement recommendations.